Howdy. This is the Poet Runner podcast. I'm Rafael Alvarado. I have my co-host, Richard Modiano, with me. Right now, we'll be speaking first to George Wallace, who edited this great book of poetry, New York City from the Inside, NYC, Through the Eyes of the Poets Who Live Here. And, George, what made you want to start to do this anthology in the first place?
The idea generated from Blue Light Press, the small boutique publisher that in San Francisco that I've done a couple of books with, Diane Frank. She did an anthology of San Francisco poets called Fog and Light about 2-3 years ago. And I said, hey, we're going to do one of these for you for New York. She said, yeah, go for it. And I was off and running. Of course, it's a huge project. There's even in San Francisco, I'm sure you could put together a 350-page book of poems, but keeping it down to 350 pages for New York City-related poets and poetry was quite a challenge.
Yeah, we've got 179 poets in here, in this anthology,
yeah.
And that is remarkably comprehensive.
I would call it, you know, not even close to the covering the ground. I mean, I tried to represent, you know, different constituencies and different intersections, and, you know, did a substantial job of it, but for this to have been exhaustive, and these are people that are all living or recently deceased, you know, I could have gone 1,000 pages and still had, you know, had to go more.
Well, when I read it, my immediate thought after finishing it was this was, for lack of a better expression, a horizontal anthology. It covered a lot of ground. Horizontal because,
yeah.
I mean, you can do a vertical anthology, but that a vertical one is much more limited in scope because it's sort of tied to a specific theme and everybody has to cover that particular theme to get in. So, I mean,
yeah.
Conceivably, you could do a series of vertical anthologies on one particular neighborhood in New York. So you could do the Lower East Side, you could do the West Village, and so on. And but I think the horizontal one is more interesting. Let's put it that way. It's much more interesting.
Is this Richard talking? Is this Richard?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a very astute observation. I mean, to me, my starting premise was to it was that New York City is a city of neighborhoods, a city of villages. Anybody who's traveled New York and lived here for a while, you start to know your turf. You go to certain places, you get to know certain people in certain places, and so you have a village, and they're not always intersecting with each other. So yeah, like you say, the Lower East Side has their people, and you know the which are not the same as the people at say the New York Weekend Cafe or people in Brooklyn or whatever. And both thematically, the aesthetics and the politics and the social identity is a fabric in New York. And to represent that, you got to do it as this kind of horizontal approach. So I try to get a few from here, a few from there, get them to communicate with each other by virtue of this book. And what's really exciting is now we're having readings, started with AWP, but maybe a dozen, 15 readings around New York City, and we're mixing up these constituencies. So people are getting a chance to meet each other and hear each other in ways that they wouldn't otherwise. The neighborhood walls are breaking down.
Yeah, that's a great idea, George. It really, because, you know, we have that here in Los Angeles as well. There are these separate constituencies, and they don't really intersect. When I was director of Beyond Baroque, as I explained to people who were like first-time readers, I said, well, at Beyond Baroque, I said, this is not like one size fits all. The people that come to hear a David St. John reading are not the people that are going to hear Kamau Daoud, who's a black poet. I mean, we're talking about separate aesthetics. And it would be great to mix those up. And I think that's what you've accomplished in this book.
Well, people, you know, I appreciate that comment because that's what we're finding is people that are suddenly in the same room together, reading together, enjoying each other's work that have never, you know, sat down before. There's a real loosening up process in the end of a two-hour session with 14, 15 poets. We've made some remarkable progress together. Now, what comes of that, I don't know, but there's a sense of broader community, which this book makes possible. We'll see how far it goes.
I think it'll go far. I mean, just bringing people together who aren't normally together is great. I mean, and you got a lot of that in this book. You got a lot of names that I normally wouldn't see together in this book. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's enormous talent. It's just so much talent. And in L.A. and in San Francisco, the major cities, I'm sure in Chicago, they don't honor Chicago so well, but yeah, the major cities of America, there's this going on. Just at New York, as you know, it goes back to, you know, back to Walt Whitman. And you know, it goes forward to the latest slam poet champion. So, I mean, without going back into the dead guys, you know, to be able to reach back at least to somebody like Robert Bly, who lived here on Bleecker Street, and just recently deceased, and he's in the book, and Diane DePrima lives in San Francisco, recently died, and she's thought of as a San Francisco figure, and some of the other ones there, and to show that Edward Field, the New York School of Poets, and people going back into the 50s, the beat poets, really, you know, they all fit into the fabric. I see a beautiful, fabric of threads of poetry that weave itself through this book.
Yeah, and I think that anybody who is not familiar with New York poetry and wants to get the full spectrum, this is the book to go to.
Well, that was my goal, you know, to make it. I don't necessarily want it to be like the Donald Hall book from the 1950s, defining New York School and beat poetry. But you know, and in a sense, it's a landmark. This is what we have out here in various directions. If you can imagine somebody planting one of those wooden street signs, 25 miles to here, 50 miles to there, 2,000 miles to Timbuktu. You know, it's put with some wooden sign pointing 50 different directions. And all of those different signs, directions and points are in this book in terms of poetry right now. Every borough is represented, different age groups, all of them.
Yeah, that's one of the great strengths of this book. In fact, it's almost, I want to say it's a unique city-centered anthology in its breadth. We've had some anthologies of Los Angeles poetry over the years starting from the 80s. Beyond Baroque published one in, I think it was like 2011, 2012. But we were never able to, at least the Beyond Baroque one that I worked on, we were never able to get this kind of breadth that you were able to do. And it must have been, I can imagine what a task it was to reach out to all of these poets. I mean,
I did have help from some people who had access to constituencies that I did not have the same level of access to that they did. You know, Jeff Wright was very important to me in getting some of the New York School poets in the St. Mark's poetry. Nancy Mercado was important for me getting Latinx poets in. But, you know, although I'm embedded in the Lower East Side and the Parkside Gallery readings, Great Weather for Media, and that series down in the Lower East Side, you know, I also have, as a journalist, I've covered, you know, all of the events at the Cathedral, St. John the Divine, the 92nd Street Y. I've had people out of the birthplace to read for me who have New York associations. That's how I got Ellen Bass from Santa Cruz to be in the book, mm-hmm. or Jane Hirschfeld, you know, from Northern California to be in the book, because I had met with them and interacted with them, you know, in other capacities besides myself as a participant in a particular niche.
Yeah. What were the primary obstacles when you got the assignment? What were the primary obstacles that you had to overcome to get all these poets?
Well, I didn't want to make the same mistake as John Foster Dulles,
right?
Who defined sphere of influence in 1950 and forgot to include Korea, you know, so that suddenly we had the Korean War. That's because he I wanted to make sure I didn't exclude anything significant. I had to reach some people, you know, very easy to communicate with. They're on Facebook, they're on Instagram, they're on email. If you send them an email, they respond quickly. Other people, it might take a month, so they might, you know, because of their email style, they may have 450 unopened emails and they miss something, you know, that you sent them. So there's just all sorts of communication obstacles to reach a certain number of people. I think that was the main thing. And the second issue was trying to keep it from getting too big. You know, I initially said I'll do it at 250 pages. But, you know, that quickly blossomed. And part of it was I didn't calculate how many pages it would take for the bios. The bios are probably 30 pages in there itself. So, I mean, you know, to keep it from ballooning up to 1,000 was important because the book's $25, which is a very reasonable cost for a book this size, 350 pages, and considering the quantity and the quality of what's in it, and the true importance of the book, it's only $25, really cheap. You know, it could have become unwieldy in terms of the cost, so nobody could possibly even buy it.
Yeah. Well, it is, it's, as they say in advertising, you are getting your full value for the $25 you spent on this book.
Yeah, you know, I have to tell you, you know, you guys are good at publishing yourself, so you know what it's like. You know, you put together a book like this and you send it out somewhere electronically and you got no idea. And you go like, well, they're going to try to cut corners, they're going to try to make a... Yeah, do what they can to make it so they can bring it in at cost, or so it makes some kind of a losing proposition, or make some a dollar or two a book or something. You know, so I was really, you know, on pins and needles before I got the first copy in the mail. I actually ordered it on Amazon.com and it came in the mail on Amazon.com. When I opened up the package and I took it out, and it was like, this is real. It's a real book. And I'm getting this from person after person that has received the book. Like yourselves, you've got the book. Now, when you open it up and you feel this book in your hand, it's a quality product, physically.
It is. It is. And were you responsible for the cover design?
I chose it was approved by the designer,
yeah.
Melanie Gendron, but I chose the photograph, and I chose very nice. Yeah,
it's not the cliched view of New York City. That's what I said. Oh, this is great. It's, you know, when you hear something about New York City from the inside, you expect to see some typical shot of Manhattan, the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, and so on. And we don't have that. I mean, we have something really. We have the bridge, which is great.
You understand then exactly what it was I was trying to go for. And when I saw this photograph, I immediately said, "This is the one for me." Why? Because, you know, it's not the Brooklyn Bridge; it's the Manhattan Bridge, which is neither here nor there so much. But the important thing is that the picture's being taken from street level, with the towering buildings on either side of you in shadow, and out past those towering, you know, down the street, up, you see the bridge apartment. So, I mean, the iconic thing, which stereotypically or in cliche terms is New York City, this is the reverse of it. This is the obverse of it. This is the visual image is New York City from the inside.
Exactly.
Right? So instead of seeing the cliche, you see from the reality out towards the cliche and beyond.
Yeah. Well, I really loved it when I got the physical book, and I said, this is great. This is really nice. Really nice.
Yeah. Had a couple of nice collages inside by Steve Dalachinsky, who we all knew and loved, the great jazz poet, died, not too long ago. Like many city artists, he was a collagist, and we have two by him in there as well, which are making a lot of nice visual relief.
Yeah, well, before I left New York City, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 months before I left New York City, when I was working at the Art Students League, and I met up with some friends from the Art Students League, and I knew Steve and Yuko before that, and by chance we happened to meet up at Film Forum to see this Japanese movie called Gate of Hell, and we saw the movie, and then we went to Chinatown for dinner, and of course Steve held forth, I did not see him again until 2018 when I was back in New York for the 50th anniversary of Beyond Baroque, when we had the reading at Hal Happening, in which you were at. You were part of that. And,
yeah,
at
Hal
Happening. And I hadn't seen Steve from 1989 until 2018, all those years. And he looked the same except that he had shaved his mustache.
Yes, hair was exactly the same. You know, it looked like it was a wig, but it wasn't. He had that same sort of perfect steel blue Superman hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I remember that day. Yeah. Well, one of the things, the reason why I called it From the Inside, aside from, what other obvious reasons you might draw from it is because, like Los Angeles, New York City is iconic to people everywhere, internationally. What is Malibu? What is the Pacific Palisades? What is the Santa Monica Pier? What is Hollywood and Vine? What is the Hollywood sign? Those are things which belong to the entire culture. So everybody, in a sense, is partially a Los Angeles person, just like they are a New York person, right? The icons, as you said, the icons of New York City. The TV shows, the movies we see, how many times have I seen a car being sold and they parked it in, next to those volleyball nets in Santa Monica? So, I mean, these things become part of the broader culture. So somebody in Kansas City or Miami, Florida, or Canada, or for that matter in Europe, these things belong to them as much as they belong to the local person. It's finding the way that we interface as local people in that situation to the things which are iconic to the people transculturally that we're really achieving things. That's why I pick poems about, even though one poem is about being embarrassed to be the Statue of Liberty based on what it says around your feet, given you're tired, you're poor. Actually, wanted to hide your eyes. That's a Karen Finney-Frock poem from Russian State. Or Edward Field, a 50s era poet, is still alive and working here in New York City, writing about steaming out of New York Harbor away from the Statue of Liberty. So all these reversals of the way that we normally think of these iconic things were things I was looking for to put in the book. So get a new perspective.
Yeah, and of course we, both cities, Los Angeles and New York, have their tragic dark sides. Last week was the 30th anniversary of the 1992 uprising here in Los Angeles. And, and of course, the World Trade Center in New York City is the equivalent of that. It's like, those are also part those are part of the general consciousness of everybody else.
Absolutely. Who didn't sit there and watch the aerial view of that blonde truck driver being pulled out of his truck and and that a person like Rodney King could say something so profound, you know, as a person who's just like an ordinary human being, you know, at the crux crisis moment for the whole nation, he said, "Why can't we just get along?" It was such an underwhelming, overwhelming statement that that should be in the Smithsonian, that statement.
Yeah, and of course, for people that live there, when these sorts of things happen, the riot uprising in Los Angeles, the destruction of the World Trade Center, if you live there and you're on the street, it is a totally different experience. I mean, I remember that I was actually going to go downtown that day, and my girlfriend said, "Don't go." She's a woman of color, and she said, "Don't go." I said, "What do you mean? Just don't go. Something is going to happen." I said, "All right." And, of course, I think it was within an hour or two of the verdict, the riot started. I mean, the riot part of it started in Compton, and it actually spread. I mean, the riot wasn't confined. The Watts riot was basically in Watts and a few adjacent areas. 92, it was all over.
Yeah.
It spread everywhere, every part of the city, from downtown to Compton, which was the sort of the epicenter of it, to Watts, to Hollywood, all the way over to Long Beach, into the San Fernando Valley. So, and although the World Trade Center coming down was confined just to Lower Manhattan, it impacted the entire city.
Well, you know, there was air conditioners 25 miles away from New York City that had the grit and dirt and bone from the collapsed towers, you know, filtered through them for weeks afterwards. So, you know, in terms of the physicality of the impact, it was, you know, it was not thermonuclear, but it spread for miles and miles away. And many people moved out of New York, out of downtown because of it. You know, I was actually in San Francisco. It took a week to get back, and I finally flew into New York City. Lower Manhattan was smoldering like a cigar, if you can imagine, flying into New York and being the tip of the Manhattan smoldering. But, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at cities, and I think that's something that I tried to get in this book as well, is that you could be somewhere and something happens two blocks away, you know, and it didn't happen to you. And it might make the news. It might even make national. It might even make international news. You know, but but it didn't. But you just walked. You just kept walking. walking. I was in San Francisco during the SLA giveaway, the Tanya Hearst. You know, they were collecting food and giving it away. I was there during the zebra killings, but you know those things didn't affect me in San Francisco because I was two blocks away. And so that's one of those very interesting things about proximity. What does proximity mean in a city?
Yeah, well, speaking of the SLA, Mark Olmsted, a poet that we both know, was working at Parker Center, which was LAPD police headquarters, during the SLA shootout back in, I guess, what was it, 73 or 4? I believe it was 74. And, of course, Patty Hearst wasn't in there. And that also happened in Compton, too, by the way.
Oh. Yeah, so...
That leads me to another question about the anthology. It's not only does it have the breadth of the different schools of poetry, for want of a better word, that exist in New York, but the subjects treated, there's tremendous diversity in that.
That's inevitable, really. I mean, you know, I suppose I could have said this to somebody, write about New York City, but that would have been dull. You know, really wouldn't have worked. You know, if it had some sort of referentiality or context, which is a New York City context, it didn't have to say, and this happened on Avenue A, for it to be a New York City poem. You know, but something about the rhythm of it, the sense of it, the subject matter of it, the context is for it. You know, those things had to be there, you know, for it to work. And so there were some cases where I sent a poem back and I said, give me a different one, you know. And these are some high power people in here.
Yeah.
I'm surprised with it, you know. But I said, you've got to give me something else. It's not going to fit. You know, and you know, it's like if you have a jigsaw puzzle with 1,000 pieces and you don't even know what the picture is you're doing, but somebody gives you a piece and you go, no, this just isn't one of the pieces. You can tell.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's like. You know, I didn't know till the 1,000 pieces, the 179 pieces were in hand in place, what this picture was. And that was exciting because that's what the creative process should be. That's what it is when I write a poem. I don't know where I'm going till I get there. So it should be in that way. It should be intuitive and experiential and creative and fluid as you're doing a thing, but to really be alive. I've always treated the material that I work with as live material, like fresco. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that you
plastic
and you put on the wall, and it's fresh, it's alive, and you're smearing it, but you know you've got to let it do its thing too before it dries out. Because once it's started to dry, you're stuck with whatever you got. That's what writing a poem is to me. You know, or watercolors, I think, are probably a little bit like that as well. So, I think that I followed my process when I put this book together to make it feel organic, as an organic, it grew organically.
Well, it is certainly that, and the other good thing about it is you can dip into it at any point. You can open it at any point and find a good poem.
Well, it is alphabetical, and there's more reasons for that than just status, or is simplicity easy to deal with. You know, it is for that reason, because, you know, I don't really like theme books of poetry that are theme books. I don't accept that people do for various reasons, but I want every poem to just be its own poem. I'm not going to read a book of poems from the front to the back. I'm going to do exactly what you said. Yeah, I pick it up, you know. I can't sleep. I turn the light on. I pick it up. And wherever I open it up, whatever page I open it up to, that's what I read. Yeah, so this does enable you to do that. So the best and the brightest and even the unknown best and brightest in the book are as readily accessible and randomly as accessible as anybody else.
Yeah, and it's also the kind of book that you can go back to again and again. Every time I, you know, when you sent me the PDF for the blurb, I read through everything in order to write a decent blurb. And then after I got my copy, I have gone through it here and there, and I've reread a few poems. And the point that I'm trying to make is that it is a book that lasts. It's a book that you can come back to and enjoy. And I think that's a tremendous accomplishment for you as an editor to have achieved that.
I was just being true to the subject. I mean, New York City is a place that you could keep coming back to. You know that.
Yeah.
Good times, bad times, you know, different neighborhoods, you know, it's inexhaustible. One doesn't keep coming back and going back to the Empire State Building and then saying, okay, I saw it, now I'll leave. Yeah, and I don't ever have to come back to New York. It's constantly evolving, constantly changing, and even if you take a snapshot of it, it's so multivariate and multivariegated that, you know, you have to have that sense that there's more than you could possibly consume or take in. Imagine trying to eat in all the good restaurants in New York, trying to see every play in New York City on Broadway. Yeah, it's just, you can't do it. So you have to learn how to sample and to establish your territory and what matters to you without losing the sense of wonder that you're in a place that has all these other things which are probably equally magical to what it is you're experiencing. If I could convey that in the book, then I think I'm conveying what New York City is.
Well, I think you've succeeded in that, George, honestly.
You know, I'm getting very good feedback on it, and, you know, I really do appreciate, you know, your comments and your insight into the book, because, I didn't know, you know, if I had known 2 years ago what I would have had to do to get to where it is today, I wouldn't have done it. It's just like, not that it was so hard, not that it was so staggering, it's just like, I didn't think that it would be this. I didn't think that it would be that it would have that kind of scope. You know, I know how to write a poem of a page or two or three pages. I don't know how to write a novel. You know, I couldn't do War and Peace. I couldn't do a 150-page novel. I just, you know, because I get lost in the process of trying it. But I think by remaining ignorant and remaining in a discovery mode, I was able to keep my head down and keep going with this book, so that it didn't overwhelm me. I feel very fortunate about that, because if I wasn't so stupid, I couldn't have done it. The stupidity really helped.
Actually, always does.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but you guys have been going so good at it. But we got about 2 minutes, and do you want to stick around for Richard's review?
Oh yeah.
Well, I don't know. I everything that I would have said separately in a review, I pretty much covered with George. I think that the points that I wanted to make to people who are interested, or who should be interested in buying this book, are its breadth, the excellence of each individual poem, the acumen of George as editor in making these selections. I was going to sort of sum up by saying, if you cannot go to New York City, read this book, and it's almost as good as having a tour from one end to the other, north, south, east, west. So my review, if I were to do it like in a movie thing, I would give it 5 stars, and I would say this is the best contemporary anthology of New York poetry that I've come across. And I've read a lot of anthologies. I've read a lot of New York poets and books that cover the New York School, the Beat School, and so on. And certainly this one stands out. And it is available from the publisher, Blue Light Press. Check your website for that. When I recommend a book, I recommend that you buy it from the publisher. And if there is a single author, buy it from the author. And then as a last resort, go to Amazon. But do support small press publishers.
All local independent bookstores have access to this book. They can order it through Ingram, book company. So if you have a bookseller that you like to go to, you ask them, they can get it within 2 days.
That's also good advice. So, yes, go to your local bookseller. Here we have Small World Books. We have The Last Bookstore. We have Stories, Books and Music, and Book Soup. So folks in the Los Angeles area, those are the places to go to ask for that book. And anything else you want to say, George?
you know what? We love L.A., you know? Us New Yorkers, we love L.A., you know? And I hope you guys love us back.
We do. We do, absolutely.
Thanks a lot for being on the show. I just let you guys go because you got, I mean, you just got it going and didn't need me to tag along today.
Well,
it was great listening
to you.
Thanks
so much for the invitation.
And we're not going to have a runner today because she wasn't able to call in. An issue Richard's had before, and I got to work on that glitch, but it was a great show. I'm glad George Wallace came on, and I'm really happy to have this book, and I thank you for sending it to me because I know it came out of your own pocket. I appreciate that.
It's actually good. That's some of the people listening to the blog.
Yeah, thanks a lot, and please keep on listening. And the next show we're probably going to have maybe Rick Looper, Charles Harper Webb, Douglas Kearney, and more to come. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, George.
Take care, guys.